Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Also, how about being our next host for the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow? I'm looking forward to two things this summer: getting back to the ballpark with my kids and getting the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow back on the calendar. If your organization would like to be a host location, let's schedule a time to chat. The Responsive Fundraising Roadshow provides 6 hours of the best fundraising training out there based on Responsive's 4 sense-making tools. Hosting Responsive's Roadshow is not like hosting a major conference that requires months of planning and all types of resources. All we need you to do is provide us with a safe learning environment for 25 adult professionals in your community who want to understand how highly effective fundraising really works. There is no cost to your organization, and we will reimburse you for all related expenses. If your organization would like to host the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow in your community, reach out and let's have a conversation today. Hi, Jessica. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast this morning. You and I have spent a few minutes familiarizing ourselves with each other before we hit the record button. And I'm on my second cup of coffee. I suspect you might be having yours too. So I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. We always invite our guests to come with a big idea or bold opinion. But before we ask you to unravel that for us, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you so much, Jason. It is such a pleasure to be here today with you. My name is Jessica Statt, and I was born and raised in Rochester, New York. I have been a fundraiser for over 22 years. I started as a teenager, actually. And I kind of fell into the field, really. And I have lived in Rochester my whole life, still live here, and now am the chief of philanthropic engagement for a company called Youth Advocate Programs, otherwise known as YAP. And so I came to YAP about a year and a half ago to build a private fundraising department. So it's been super great and just a really amazing opportunity. And I love fundraising.
So I talk about this a lot, and I talk about this in my forthcoming book, because you and I have the same timeline. So you started fundraising about the same time. It sounds like you're a little younger because I wasn't quite in high school. But if you were raising money, if you started raising money about 22 years ago, then you started raising money around the time of September 11th. And so if you think about it, we got September 11th, we've got the recession that followed, you know, 8 to 10 years later, and then you've got COVID-19. And I think those are two, tell me if I'm wrong, do those sort of seem to be three extraordinary markers on our fundraising careers, those of us who have been in it for about 20 years, like you said. What do you think about that?
Wow. Yeah, such a great point. So I think as fundraisers in this field, you have to really pay attention to what's going on in the world. And it, when big events like that happen, to me, it's an opportunity to pause and reflect on how I've been doing my work and kind of see how I can change it. Because, you know, when the whole world stops like that, if you don't stop and pay attention to what's happening around you, you're not going to maintain your relevancy. So, you know, I want to be like nimble. I want to be that fundraiser who can roll my sleeves up and be nitty gritty and do what's needed to be done. And I've been an office of one for a year. So it's been very real to me. But, you know, starting my fundraising career, you're right, right around September 11th was a huge, huge challenge. The economy was all crazy. I mean, and I was really just starting, so I didn't know a whole lot. So I started working in the arts, actually. I started as a development assistant at Glimmer Glass Opera in Cooperstown, New York. And the only reason I was given that opportunity was because I was actually an opera singer and I was going to school for music. And I thought, I want to be a musician and I'm going to be this famous opera singer. But I just couldn't let go of that want to understand everything about the agency. And that hunger, on top of just really being fascinated by people, is really what keeps me going. So when we're talking about events like 9/11 and we're talking about COVID, we're just people doing work with other people. And so if we don't pay attention to how people are feeling and what's going on in the world around us, we're not going to be successful fundraisers. So, you know,
I think you're the first. I'm sitting here thinking, so we've broadcast 250 plus episodes. I think you're the first upstate New York fundraiser that I've had on the show. You said Cooperstown, New York. So that's up. I'm guessing that's upstate New York as well. And you're from Rochester. So is there, before we dive into your subject, tell me if there's any, is there anything different to raising money everywhere else in the state of New York, compared to raising money in New York City? Or is it pretty much all the same?
It's all different. I think it's different everywhere. You know, so like if I'm comparing upstate New York to New York City, I've done fundraising in both. Okay. So it's more individuals in big metropolitan areas like that, I feel like. It's like really the wealth lies in those top of the pyramid people.
Yeah.
But I find in like, because now I manage national fundraising, so we do fundraising all over the globe. I'm learning about all these different areas across the U.S. and what is where the fundraising is. And in more rural areas, it's mostly community foundations. So that's what I'm seeing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We're in central Pennsylvania. So we're and we have these two big, you know, bookend sort of cities, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And I would probably say it's a lot of individual wealth. There's a lot of foundations that are tied to individual wealth, old money. And then you're right, our community foundation, like here in my little community, York, Pennsylvania, even though there's a lot of individual wealth, all that sort of filters through the community foundation in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? So all those rich white folks that, you know, that we're constantly sort of stirring ourselves up with the angst related to that, it's sort of concentrated in this institution known as the local community foundation, which I guess could be a whole nother, could probably be a conversation in and of itself. Jessica, when we invite people like yourself to come on the podcast, we ask you, not me, to come on with your big idea or bold opinion. I've got plenty of them, and usually about 20 minutes in or so, I get to jump up on my soapbox. But how about you unravel yours for us today? And I can assure you that there's probably a lot of fundraisers out there that share your opinion, and there might be some that don't, but let's hear it.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I believe that being a fundraiser and being the best fundraiser means being who you are and being truly authentic to who you are. But that's kind of scary, right? Because oftentimes as fundraisers, we're kind of like putting on a show or performing. Yeah. You know?
Yes.
And so I really believe that you have to be authentic to who you are. I tried for a very long time to fit into a box of what I thought a fundraiser should be. And I fell every time. I didn't succeed. I didn't understand, you know, like I'm just being myself here, you know, like, and that doesn't work for every agency either, you know, like it really depends. And so I feel like it's about being yourself, fundraising really from the heart and really like connecting and finding those common threads. You know, that's what we're looking for here. You know, like I was listening to something about relationship building and, and being a fundraiser is about being likable. So oftentimes I was finding myself like, am I not likable? Do people not like me? But really what it came down to was just finding the right match and the right style of fundraising. And so, you know, now I'm overseeing all of our private fundraising. I oversee everything we do with individuals and corporations and foundations. And so it's a beast, but that also comes with the ability to find the right funders, which I think is really important too, and bringing the right funders in the right way. You know, oftentimes I get challenged by the culture of an agency that maybe isn't used to fundraising. I used to consult. I've worked at hospitals. I worked at the local university here. And I found that the people who are not versed in fundraising were often challenging. Like, why are we doing this work? Like, why are we putting ourselves out there like that? And I really think if we don't put ourselves out there, we are never going to make the change that's necessary. And it comes down to people connecting with other people to make that change happen. So I really believe in just bringing myself, you know, if it's a bad day, hey, it's a bad day. Everybody has them.
But some of this, I don't know if it's my privilege or if it's because I'm a white guy, but is some, I don't think I have heard a number of people sometimes on the record and sometimes off the record tell me on the podcast here that they struggle with being able to, because I think this is what you're saying. They struggle with being able to show up as their real selves. If I can sort of put that thing, sort of frame it, but it's not typically white males that typically say that. For example, I think the last person that told me that was a woman of color. And we all know that the fundraising profession consists of a large number of women, for example. A lot of white women are doing this work. And I remember back when we first launched this podcast, I had a guest on the – Sam LaProd was my guest on the podcast, and she was speaking at fundraising conference Congress up in Toronto, and I got her on there right after her speech, and she talked about imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome had never sort of hit my radar. I had never – I never felt like, and still to this day, probably would not say that I have ever felt like an imposter at the lunch table, for example. Is it because, is it a gender thing?
Gosh, I mean, I think it's a gender thing. It's a race thing. It's a culture thing. It's a society thing. It's a class thing. It's an everything thing. But, you know, good for you for recognizing it. At least you can recognize that discomfort. And I think that's where amazing work is happening right now. You know, we are pushing funders right now to come forward with more money, with more commitment and more vigor than ever before. But we also have to show up at the table as fundraisers with that same amount of passion. And I feel like sometimes that's lacking. And I think it's because maybe we're not being ourselves. We're not being true to who we are. But that you bring up a great point. Are we able to be? I'm not sure. You're right. I mean, there's so much pressure on us to hit the numbers, to, you know, meet with quantity. And really, you know, I just don't believe that that results in good for all the people involved. So,
when I was in Washington, D.C., Danielle and I, Danielle is an African-American woman, and she and I would travel the country. And I think what her and I working together really taught me, I mean, she showed up as I like to think, and I'm not questioning it. I think she showed up about as real as you could perhaps show up. And I think I have always shown up as real. And it was very meaningful work in the sense, because we sort of got to watch the way that we sort of showed up. But Jessica, I think part of what my angst about this notion of fundraisers saying to me that they want to show up and they want to show up as real is, I don't know if they're showing up enough in the places that matter. Like, we tolerate a bunch of marginalized sort of roles inside the organization. And like my guest that I was talking to yesterday on the podcast, far too often we tolerate these roles where we're not ultimately, we're sort of like these master technicians. And when I think of a technician, I'm thinking of the tech guy who's basically tinkering under the hood of my minivan out in my yard, you know, in my driveway. Right. If you're a technician, I don't know that you're supposed to, quote unquote, show up as your real self. You're supposed to be a technician. You're supposed to fix under the hood. Is part of the problem that we have to, because I think the world, here's me on my first soapbox here, it is part of the world sort of waking up to the idea that we're all in our grand diversity going to become our full selves. And as a result of this, Jessica, is fundraising going to become something it's not known to be right now? Like 10 years from now, it sounds to me like 10 years from now, if we all start showing up the way that we really are and who we truly are, fundraising might be remarkably different.
Yeah, I mean, right? You're absolutely right. But I would challenge you to say, what's wrong with that? Like, what's wrong with it being completely different? We should evolve.
Oh, I'm not saying anything's wrong with it. I'm excited about it. I just want to make sure I get to interview all the people who show up in the best ways. I don't have any problem with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you bring up such a great point. You're talking about imposter syndrome. Like, I think it's just so great that you're even acknowledging that it exists. But you're right. I'm a white woman, and I have been given this opportunity, and I've been given lots of opportunities because of my privilege. I know that.
Sure.
So, and I'll share with you, I've had a difficult life, and that's what brought me to this field. I left my home when I was a teenager and lived on my own. I was emancipated. I jumped from couch to couch. I had friends that helped me, and I was on my own from the age of 16 on, which is not that young. It's not that rare. Like, there's many people who have gone through much worse, but for me, that was my story.
Yeah.
And I live by this saying. I really love Glennon Doyle, and so she says, "There's no glory except through your story."
Yeah.
And I really believe that. It wasn't until I showed up at the table and I embraced who I was with all of my flaws and the biases that I bring to the table every day, really acknowledge that for what they are, and then try to work on them. And I think that's all we can do. But we have to use our positions and our voices for good. I think that my fundraising is my superpower. I think that I was given this gift that, I happen to be good at it. I didn't go to school for it. I just was given an opportunity. And I think that, we're talking about race and we're talking about implicit bias. We're talking about these things. It exists.
Yeah.
So, to me, it's about.
So I get the privilege of, with my podcast, I get to pull it out of people. If people aren't forthright about their stories, like you just shared with us, I get to pull it out of people anyway. That's some of the privilege that comes with being a podcaster. And I'm sure it comes with being radio host and other people who do this sort of stuff. But how often do you get to tell that, bring that story to the table with your donors?
Well, in a previous life, never.
Okay.
Because, fundraising at a university is different from fundraising for an agency that does juvenile justice work, so we don't all have that privilege.
You get to bring that story to the table now.
I do. I do. But, I didn't really want to, and I was really scared about it.
And are you a better fundraiser because you do?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
I think we're the best fundraisers when we bring all of those things to the table. And then once we do, it's like, you just find the right people around you. You find the right opportunities if you're willing to. And then if you embrace those things that are brought around you, that's all I've done. I've just kind of made the best of my situations. And I think that's why I admire people who have had more adversity than me. It's like, I had it tough, but I'm still a white lady. I still have a great job and I still have a beautiful home. I have everything that I need and I'm loved.
Yeah.
But if I don't dedicate every day of my working life to helping to bring up, especially Black, Indigenous, people of color in every way, whether it be through my work directly or through mentoring people or, through my hiring process, like any of that, like just building in diversity in every way, I feel like, you know, now is the moment and we really have to embrace it.
Okay. I don't know if anybody's ever written this, but it's definitely a theory that's sort of simmering in my head. Maybe you've got the theory. Maybe we can theoretically share it. I think adversity makes you a better fundraiser. And so in some ways, because I got to say, it's probably my, so when I was working with Danielle at the Epilepsy Foundation, it wasn't my privilege. It wasn't because I was a white straight male that necessarily allowed me to connect with my donors. It was because I grew up with a kid with a seizure condition, right? That was what allowed me to connect with my donors. It's what allowed me to be passionate about the research that we were doing. And consequently, I was better at raising money in many cases. I would say that it was the adversity that sort of related me to my donors in many cases. And I have oftentimes thought that, for example, women of color in this work, I think absolutely are remarkably talented at doing this work. And it's actually, and I think I've talked to women of color who basically understood and acknowledged sort of what I'm saying here, that it's their adversity. It's the adversity that they've experienced. And you're a woman, so let's not make it about women of color, but let's make it about you being a woman, for example.
Sure.
You've experienced adversity because you're a woman, perhaps, throughout your life. So in some ways, does that adversity actually make you better at doing this?
I think so. I mean, you're right. Like, we should write the book, Jason. Get on it.
I mean, you can just write it. I've got a right. book I'm
writing. I know. I can't wait.
I really think that adversity, I think there's something in that adversity that makes, in some ways, I think it may be the humility that oftentimes comes as a necessity with adversity. Like, you can sit yourself down at that table, but it's also what concerns me about us never getting to that table. I think there's a lot of fundraisers who've experienced adversity by whatever definition it happens to be, and they're not getting to the table often enough. And then the very privileged person who's sitting across the table with them, who has all this affluence and da-da-da-da that sort of comes with that, I think sometimes these donors sit at the table wanting to sort of see and touch and experience that adversity. And sometimes we as fundraisers are that vehicle to sort of let them touch it, you know, and I don't mean touch it in any appropriate sense. I just mean that we're helping them sort of connect their lives of privilege and whatever else comes with that to something that they've never sort of touched in any meaningful way. But I don't think we're at the lunch table enough.
No, I don't think so either. And that's why I think we have to do it as individuals first. And if we're in positions of power or privilege, we have to lead by example. So I have to come to the table with my adversity, with my flaws, with all of it. Yes. And I have to be honest about it, you know?
Yes.
But it's very tough to do. And you touch on a great thing, you know? What we're looking for here is a common thread, right? The majority of the work we're doing is relationships. And so when you're sitting down having a conversation, you're right. Like, adversity brings that little something that makes you real. It makes you, like, it gives you that connection with the other person because they can see, like, ah, you're a real person too. But, you know, how do you find the balance between, like, how much adversity can you really bring without being judged? And that's a tough place to be when you're expected to come home with the check. So.
Okay. So I keep picking up on this message from some of my guests. Now, understand, I get the benefit of having a conversation with a fundraiser several times a week. And I oftentimes have this 45-minute conversation, but I also tend to have 45-minute conversations after we stop recording, right? And I tend to think that, what I tend to hear lately, Jessica, is that a lot of that adversity isn't coming from the donor, but it's coming from the boss. The idea that we can't show up, the idea that if you show up in a particular way, I think the photograph, Jessica, you had red hair at some point. Am I right? Did you have red hair?
Okay, I do.
But you had redder hair in the photograph that I saw on the internet. Am I right?
Yeah. Okay. Super bright red.
Yes. Okay. So if you showed up, what I tend to hear, and I've talked to somebody about writing about this for our fall journal. What I tend to hear is that the adversity that they encounter about showing up is more about the fears and anxieties and reservations that the boss has, or perhaps the board has, about you showing up at the lunch table than even whether or not the donor gives a damn how you show up. Like, I don't think these donors live in a world where they get to sort of curate who shows up at the lunch table with them. They have meetings of the sort that we're talking about all the time. And across the, you know, the bigger the enterprise that they happen to be associated with, the more likely it's an international audience. It's perhaps as diverse as you could possibly be. Why the hell can't fundraisers work for bosses that let you show up? That's kind of the question I want to ask.
Yeah, I mean, I want to ask it too, but I'm a boss, so.
So you're a boss, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, you know, I have a staff now, and so it's my responsibility in this role, especially since I'm building a whole department from scratch, because my agency happened to have been funded by the government since 1975. Yeah. So it's a very unique situation. But I think really, if we go back to the beginning of our conversation, I think that COVID has given us an opportunity to rethink how we operate in business overall.
Yeah.
And so I really think that if bosses or people in positions of power like that can give feedback, that can say, hey, it's okay for you to be yourself, we have to do more of that. And then we have to recruit people who aren't perfect. We have to recruit people who maybe, you know, don't have CFREs or, you know, not that there's something wrong with that. That's great. Sure. But I didn't have $900 to pay for that. So I I think that we have to start rethinking, you know, what makes a good fundraising professional? Because at the core of this work, it's about conversations and it's about finding a common thread between the agency and the donor. And however you get there, you know, it's got to be donor-centric, right? But sure. I really believe that you can do it in this way. It's just, you know, striking a great balance.
Yeah, I'm not. So we have a podcast conversation that's broadcasting here this week. That's broadcasting this week. It was a guy who asked, you mentioned donor centricity, and he did a survey. And any of my listeners who saw this a couple of weeks ago, we posted it here on the podcast. He did a survey because he had posted a question on social media asking the question of whether or not sort of donor centricity was sort of out of vogue anymore. And there was a disconnect. The question was, is it sort of on its way out? And the interesting thing about the observation that he made, and folks, if you're interested, you can go back and listen to this conversation that I had with Scott Myers is his name. Scott basically was able to scan the 349 responses that he got. And what he basically was able to very quickly assess is that the guardians of the note, whatever the hell we describe as donor centricity, the guardians of donor centricity were basically old white guys. And so I wonder if part going back to sort of just 5-10 minutes ago, I wonder if some of our notions of even what the work looks like and our buzzwords that we throw around like donor centricity and stuff, that's some of the stuff that really excites me 10 years out. Because I think somebody like yourself, Jessica, who isn't an old white guy working for a large institution, is going to come up with the new ideas. And if we can get your ideas out there faster than I can, I mean, has it ever occurred to you, Jessica, that see soapbox number two, has it ever occurred to you that basically the experts out there come up with buzzwords so that they can get contracts and keynotes? That's basically what these buzzwords are for. If you trace that, if you trace donor centricity all the way back, it's for somebody who wanted to basically come up with a marketing concept. But Jessica, I don't think you're describing to me marketing work. You just want to sit at the lunch table and have a meaningful relationship with somebody who can basically move the dime on whatever your organization's trying to do. I don't think you really give a damn what we call it.
No, I don't. And honestly, I mean, you're right. Yes. It is. And I mean, maybe because I'm not the sort of fundraiser that does keynotes. Maybe I should. I don't know.
No, you're not. You don't need to. You need to be raising a hell of a lot of money for something that lines up with that adversity you experienced as a youth.
Absolutely. You know, there is a different line of thinking, but you're right. You know, it's not about, I use donor-centric because I in my brain, I think that's recognizable. But, you know, we're not changing anything by using that stuff. So you're right. It's about the relationships. It's about that lunch table. And then it's about, you know, bringing new people. You know, I really think that there's a lot of crossover happening between public and private sector, between foundations and individuals. And now, you know, has it always been old white men? Yep. And right. I mean, when I started, when I was 19 years old,
yeah,
that had an effect on me. You know, it really did. I mean, I was fundraising for, you know, an arts organization in New York City, and that is really who it was.
And tell me what that means when you said it had an effect on you. Help me understand what that means. What does that mean?
I mean, being a woman in fundraising.
Being a 19-year-old woman.
Being a... Yeah, a very young woman.
You were like my daughter. I mean,
I was a baby.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd want you raising money by yourself in New York City at 19. But anyway.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, that was
patriarchy coming out. Sorry about that.
Right. No, thank you. I appreciate. I mean, you know, it was really. I mean, I had to do what I had to do to survive. You know, yes. Like I didn't have a home, so I was on my own at 16. So by 19, I thought I was like 35 with the wisdom of a 60-year-old or something.
Right. Right. But,
you know, in the time I didn't know, I was very naive and I didn't understand the playing field really. And so I think that kind of protected me a little bit, but I mean, I was going to big parties at the Waldorf Astoria and you're right. You know, it affected me because it gave me the notion that these white men controlled my future.
Yeah.
And that they controlled the future of nonprofits and they controlled the work that would be done. That made me so mad. You know, just like, I think that's what still fuels me today. You know, that little bit of angry down in my stomach. That's
angst,
like,
yes.
You know, I don't think pain is always necessary for growth. But for me, unfortunately, I've had to lean into pain to grow. And when I was younger, you know, I definitely felt like I had to play up the pretty young girl.
Yes. But
I don't do that anymore.
So how long did it take you? Did it, forgive me for asking, but I'm a podcaster, so I got to pull this out of people. Did something tragic happen? Or did you just sort of over time realize that this was icky and it wasn't right? And did it, the reason I asked that is because it seems to me a lot of the people that, for example, a lot of people that picked up my first book, and trust me, my first book was not anywhere trying to address this particular issue. But it seems to me like we've got a lot of fundraisers out there who are about 10 to 12 years into their fundraising career where their eyes sort of open up. So regardless of who they happen to be, they sort of start to think more critically about this. And so if we just assume that people sort of land in these fundraising roles, perhaps at the earliest in their early 20s, it's sort of the 32 to 35 year old that I'm oftentimes sort of most intrigued listening to, because oftentimes they're at that very early place where they're starting to think very critically about what they're doing. Is that the place, or was it earlier than that for you?
No, I think you're right on. It was right around 30 to 35 when I figured it out.
Yeah.
And I think you're touching on, you know, there's so much pressure on young fundraisers because you feel like you have to prove yourself, you have to hit these numbers, you know, and that's what I'm trying to challenge here. Like, it should really be more about quality relationships and strategic fundraising. Like, you know, it's much better to build a relationship over 18 months with a billionaire than it is to get a flash in the pan $1 million tomorrow. So, but
did it take you? Did you have to be 32 to figure that out? Did your boss not know that? That took me about 24 months to figure out. I don't think it took me 12 years. And that's part of what excites me about that young generation that we're talking about is I think there's a generation of young people that are going to transition into senior roles that, like, they're going to start running our nonprofit shops and they're going to start running the shops in accordance with that, because I think there's too many bosses out there. And forgive me, bosses, and you know who you are, but the bosses out there that are retiring now have tried to in many cases, operate shops like that, where you basically are trying to literally close million-dollar gifts tomorrow, and that doesn't work. And it's just as exploitive, in my opinion, of the rich, wealthy white guy as it is the young woman who's soliciting the gift. It's exploitation. Absolutely. On both sides. So,
yeah, we're not doing donors any favors by, you know, just doing those quick deals.
No, it's. So did it really take you 12 years to figure that out? Or did it take you 12 years to have the audacity to say it, that you can't run relationships like that?
I think it probably took me, you're right, more like a handful of years to realize that was necessary, but probably until I was in my 30s to realize that I could say something about it and that it wouldn't risk my career, you know?
Yeah.
And that's
at 26, were you chasing after that CFRE in your mind?
No, because I feel like I had already proven myself, you know, so like I had been able to achieve so many dollar figure milestones.
Okay.
And so that to me was kind of like speaking for itself, but having that certification matters more to some people than others. And just in my field, it just didn't, at least with the people that I was working with.
Yeah, because I don't think that at 26, because I think there's like a lot of 26 to 30 year olds who are chasing that because they've now been in 5 years. But I don't know that the CFRE, for example, is structured in such a way where it teaches them that. Some of the intuitive and some of the qualitative stuff that fundraising is supposed to teach us, I don't think it's structured. That would be my critique. I've been certified twice. I've gone through the rigmarole, and I've always been fortunate enough to have the $900. I've always had the money to figure that out, but I don't think it qualitatively and intuitively sort of trains up the intuition you've probably got now. And I think I think there's an apprenticeship type. So, okay, so sort of continuing on the path that we're going. So if I'm thinking about Jessica as a supervisor now, am I right to say that you could probably apprentice some remarkably talented fundraisers? I think that's what probably excites me the most.
Me too. I love that. You know, honestly, it's hard though, because, you know, I have so much responsibility for the bottom line at my agency, but I think you have to make time for it and you have to build it in. And so what I am trying to do as I build a team is to think about more than just what the traditional fundraising training would be and look at people for what they are and bringing those, you know, biases and flaws and all of the good stuff that makes them real people, and just recognizing that. And honestly, what it comes down to is like a couple of key traits, you know, like, are you a good communicator?
Yeah.
Are you, you know, can you write well? Like there's, you know, and so that sort of thing, I feel like you can hone in on and you can really recognize and say, hey, like, I can lead the strategy here. Like I have loads of strategy. You know, I didn't do this for 20 years to not be full of ideas. But when I think we struggle as fundraisers is like putting the you know, hitting the pavement and actually enacting plans. And so I can plan all I want and advise people on what to do if I have the people to do the actions. And so, you know, to me, it's more about like letting go of a little bit of the control about how I think fundraising needs to be.
Yeah.
And also, you know, keeping all of the stuff in mind that we've talked about, the biases that are involved and getting people at the lunch table and who's invited and all that, you know, really, really being mindful about who I hire, you know, and who I bring onto my team, because that's what I have power over and control over now. So I have two young ladies on my team right now who are, one lives in Tennessee, one lives in New Jersey. They're both young women in their 20s, 30s. And they are both women of color, and they are both learning to be fundraisers. And I love it.
If you don't mind me sort of pressing on that, how close are they going to be to the donor? How quickly are you going to get them in front of the donors?
I just hired a young woman about a month ago that is coming in kind of like a mid-level gift officer position.
Yeah.
But she does not have direct experience in it. She's been kind of peripheral. She's got a lot of programmatic experience.
Yeah, sure.
And she's a great communicator. So I think probably she'll be ready to do visits on her own yeah. within the next 6 months.
Okay.
And that's just because she's shadowing me. And
that's what I'm telling donor. That's what I'm telling fundraisers. I'm like, get in front of the donor as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
The thing that I think I've, so if we put the word adversity as an advantage on the fundraiser, I think the thing that we have to understand, and I'm sure you've seen this, some of these donors that I've interacted with over the years, they may be the richest, wealthiest, affluent, you know, how many words can you sort of attach to having money to their, to how many adjectives can you use? But they're also lonely. And I think some of the reasons that we don't sort of pick up on the reason that they're showing up at the lunch table, and they will unravel that, just like your willingness to sort of unravel your story as a youth, for example, they'll unravel their money story with you within the first half hour. And I don't think we sort of understand. I don't think that they're necessary. I said this recently with another guest. I don't think they're the monster in the room. I tend to pick on the experts in our field. I think we've got to have sort of some new experts that sort of redefine what the problems are. And I don't think that rich white woman, rich white fella is necessarily the monster at the table. I think in some cases he's lonely as hell. And if you know how to do your job well, I mean, the young woman you're describing there, she just has to be coached up to be rock solid, strong as hell at that lunch table, not feel like she has to be impressionable and right. I mean, what are the things she's got to learn before you put her in front of that donor?
Well, first of all, you know, this adversity, you know, theme that we're talking about, and you bring up this great point about, like, who is the monster in the room?
Right.
You know, I agree with you. You know, I don't really think there's a monster in the room, but I mean, I think that you're right. That it's not the only the donor's job to do right here, you know, we can't leave it up to the people. You know, we have a lot of power as fundraisers because money makes the world go round. Money makes programs happen. It pays salaries, you know, and so that really controls a lot in the future of a nonprofit, especially when you're driving a main source of revenue. But with that, you know, comes responsibility. And then, you know, you're sharing that with this donor, and you're right. Many of these donors will share their life story with you.
They will like totally unravel it. And then I think that's okay. So when I'm talking to someone who tends to have a lot of animosity to the donor, I tend to want to push them a little further and find out how many times they've actually been at the lunch table with these people. I mean, I totally know that there's jerks out there that totally take advantage of these people. But I think 95% of these donors that we're talking about actually are some of the loneliest people in the world. Their affluence sort of just screams out in front of them. And so it's really the only thing we see. And then in some cases, they just want to be treated like human beings, and they don't. And what we have to do is know how to come to the table and sort of, you know, as peers, not let their affluence, their age, their affluence, their power, whatever, sort of linger on, you know, linger above the conversation.
Yeah. And I mean, let that adversity connect you. You know, everyone has had trials and tribulations. Everyone has had difficulties in life. And I think that's why when you're a real person at the lunch table, it's easier to fundraise. I mean, I'm good at what I do. I know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it because I, you know, studied research on fundraising every day? No, it's because I went out and did the work.
Yes.
But it's also because I am challenging this idea that fundraisers are robots, and that we need to go out and do the same motions and dances in front of the same 25 wealthy white men like we're talking about.
For the sake of my listener, Jessica literally just pretended like she was a robot.
It was a good move, right?
Your body just did that. That's extraordinary.
Thank you. But, you know, we want to be real people, you know? So I think that when you come to the table as a real person, and maybe that, you know, for me, my adversity works because I work for an agency that happens to be a second chance agency. You know, we live and breathe in giving people another opportunity at life. And so, you know, great for me.
That's I had never thought about it that way. See, I had never thought about it that way, Jessica. But in some cases, when we show up real, when you show up real as hell, whoever the hell you happen to be, and you've got a rich, wealthy, you know, person across the lunch table, if you would, because one of the things that we do in our coaching is we tell our coaches, I mean, we tell our clients, we say, get money on the table. Acknowledge that money is a part of the relationship. But I think in some ways, when we do that, it allows the donor to show up real too, because if you sort of skirt around the issue that you're literally sitting across the table with a super rich person and you don't acknowledge their wealth, it doesn't mean you have to give it precedence over anything else. It's just acknowledging, just like everything else that characterizes who we are.
Absolutely.
Because then they feel there's a freedom that comes with the fact, like I'm thinking of a woman that I was working with a client in Los Angeles for a number of years, and my client and I would routinely meet with this woman who was probably the third wealthiest individual in the Santa Clarita Valley in Los Angeles. And I think about the fact that how many times she felt like she had to show up not real because people wouldn't acknowledge who she was. Like, I think in some ways she wanted to know, not so that you had to kiss her ass, but so that you that people, you know, just acknowledge the fact and let me acknowledge the fact that I've probably got way too much wealth that I need to have. And then let's build another, you know, let's build a meaningful relationship on the other side of that. But until you acknowledge that it's sitting there, how the hell can you do that?
I know. I think it's so funny when, like, you know, oh, I'm not here for money. And it's like, well, yeah, I am, you know, like that's the bottom line of everything I do. And so,
yeah,
you know, I'm the chief of philanthropy. So if that doesn't say fundraising to you, and we even use like a fancy word too, right, to make it seem like
it's, you know, something else.
Yeah, it's something else. But, you know, what it comes down to is like, that is what it is. It's about the dollars on the table. And as fundraisers in these roles, we have the power to set the stage of the room. You know, it's interesting, actually. I saw a masterclass about hostage negotiations. Yeah. Not that donors are hostages, but I think that the art of negotiation is very interesting. Okay. And I think that it plays a big role in conversation, like especially when you get down to the ask, like negotiating, you know, and really when you call in like a hostage negotiator, right, they're there to get that person to do whatever they say. And that's really kind of, as fundraisers, what we're doing too. Like, we're coming to the table because we have this ulterior motive. But what it comes down to with the negotiator is like finding that commonality. Like, how do you connect on a real level with that person to get them off the ledge? And I think it's very similar in this way. We have earned this. If you're a fundraiser out in the field working, sitting across the table from those wealthy people, you've earned it. You have earned it. And so, bring that value in yourself to the table and know that you have that, and that, you know, we are equals. You know, we're all, like, we're talking about the adversity. We all have something. So I think it really is, we have more power than we give ourselves credit for. If you come into the room, you have the power to set the stage, and you're right. Be real, like mention, point to the elephant in the room. And then you can have a real conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Jessica, do you put this stuff on paper? You've obviously thought this stuff through. And, you know, for a guy like me, so I've hired a writing coach who helps me get this stuff on paper. I'm just curious, have you written this stuff down?
I have notebooks full of writing, but I've never really officially done anything with it. But who knows? Maybe I will. Who knows?
Yeah, start writing something down and I'll help. Your friends at Responsive Fundraising will help you get it out there. I think one of the things that frustrates me, and one of the things we're trying to do at Responsive, is elevate and celebrate sort of the voices that are on the fringe. And I think individuals like yourself who you know, you're not in New York City, you're up in upstate New York and you're raising money. You're not necessarily on, you know, you're not at some consulting shop, for example, that gets all the keynotes and the contracts, as I reference. And I think those are the types of people that when we talk about, so when I hear an organization tell me we've got to, in fundraising, we've got to champion some of these diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives, I'm thinking, okay, that's fine, but the institutions that are going to do that are the ones that are actually touching the work, that are actually doing the work, the ones that are going to be able to deliver on that. And I don't know that that's what we're sort of seeing and hearing. And so listening to you describe your own experiences and to hear you describing who you're hiring, for example, and then to even piece together how you're going to train them up, and me understanding sort of, you know, just sort of piecing together everything you've shared with us in the last 45 minutes, really gives me a sense of how much more holistically and organically we can sort of accomplish these things. Does that make sense? It's totally organic, and it's not going to happen in the halls of some consulting shop. It's going to happen or at an association or some corporate board. It's going to literally happen on the ground in Rochester, New York. What do you want? Before I let you go, what do you want for those two? You described two young women that you just hired, two women of color. What do you want for them 10 years from now? I'm going to put you on. What do you want from them? Because they may not be. If what I may want for them is them not to actually be working for you, because most young people these days are not going to be working for you 10 years out. So where do you want them to be?
Thank you so much for asking that, because I think it's important we think about the people that work with us.
Yeah.
So to me, I hope that I can give them the confidence that I've been able to earn over the years. And yeah, I hope that they can show up at that table with all sorts of different people.
Yeah.
But they can be their real selves, and they can be comfortable and really truly comfortable in who they are at that table. I think then we'll really be talking about equity and inclusion. And I really have a lot of hope in the younger fundraisers. You know, I would love to be out of the job and, you know, be moving out of the way for some great up and comer. So yeah, I embrace it.
Yeah. Yeah. Jessica, I think you and I connected on LinkedIn. I delight in these conversations. Some of them I delight in more than others. And this is certainly at the top of my list. I've really enjoyed this conversation this week. If somebody else is listening to this conversation, and trust me, people get back to me and they say, hey, you know who I like Jessica, people have picked up on consulting gigs out of this. So don't be shy on this. Tell people how they can find you if they're interested in reaching out to you.
Absolutely. So my name is Jessica Statt. I am on LinkedIn, but you can also email me at giving@yapinc.org. It's giving@yapinc.org. And I would love to embrace some new people in my life that believe that adversity makes us better fundraisers and that we can make this world a better place with our talents.
Thank you, Jessica. It's been a pleasure. You're always welcome back.
Thank you so much. The pleasure has really been mine.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.